Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. Andrew Campbell about digital mental health. Andrew is an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney and a founding member of their cyber psychology research group. He is also an adjunct professor of cyber psychology for the Asia Pacific University of Technology and Innovation and a senior fellow of the Higher Education Academy in the UK. And he is also a freelance advisor with Leap Forward and Leora.ai. Welcome, Andrew. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. It's great.
Andrew, before we get chatting in about the work you do and the research that you've been involved in, I'd really like to know more about you and what that turning point was for you, or that pivot point for you was getting into cyber psychology.
It actually started when I was an undergraduate student. I did an overseas placement, I suppose, or an overseas stay at New York University. And I was interested in a particular class at that time that was looking at, this is just to give the context, it was 1997. It was looking at how people were interacting with other people online anonymously and why they were disclosing their most private sort of thoughts and feelings to complete strangers. And this was a time when I don't think people really considered how their information, data, or whatever else was going to be used. It was just a community reach out in a lot of ways. And the class raised more questions than it gave answers. It was all on social psychology. But it was a case of arguing that, you know, if people are going online to seek help, why aren't there mental health services online? And is that the future? And so I came back to Australia and I was in a master's in applied behavioral science at the time, doing drug and alcohol addictions. And a lot of people in the clinics that I was working in had the same sort of perspective of, you know, it's great to be here to, and this is in rehab clinics, to recover and reassess my life. But once I'm outside of this, what's going to keep me, you know, connected to the goals that I'm setting myself? And they wanted to have an online presence as well. So around 1999, I pitched my PhD idea to my lecturers that were potentially going to supervise me. And all of them were bewildered to think that I wanted to study psychology on the internet. The way they saw it, and keep in mind the word Y2K didn't even come up at this point. It was just a case of the internet, it's a new fun thing. They overwhelmingly said to me, if you study something online as a psychologist, you'll be killing your career. Because the way they viewed it was people online weren't people online. And I couldn't get my head around that. I was like, well, of course we're people online, you know, well, of course we're people, I should say. So I literally was told by one professor, no, there's no such thing as online psychology or cyber psychology. I mean, these words weren't words that anybody thought about at that time. And no one would supervise me. That was it. This is in Australia. There was no university here that wanted to supervise me. So I had to get people in the United States and UK to sort of write letters to say it is a thing and we'll happily advise, but they couldn't be official advisors. So we ended up getting a psychologist to be my advisor, but guided by international groundbreaking experts at the time, people like John Sular and Azzy Barrack and people like that. So it was one of those times where we had to convince psychologists in Australia, mental health's moving online, whether you like it or not, so we better research it. It's a bit of a long-winded answer, but it took 3 years to get there and then got out the other end, and rest is history.
And there's quite a number of cyber psychologists now in Australia and kind of focused in Sydney. How is cyber psychology growing in Australia? Is it quite growing quite quickly? Is there quite a lot of interest now starting to build?
I would say yes. However, it has been a slow growth. So from when I graduated with my PhD and began an academic appointment, it was still very much frowned upon, although in the media, it was talked about a lot. You know, online addiction, gaming disorders, all of that was there. And then, of course, with 2004 and Facebook coming about, the social media boom. It really picked up in Australia and New Zealand more around 2010, early 20-teens. And then progressively really took hold in the different focus areas of, as I mentioned before, like gaming disorder, gambling online, online relationships. One of Australia's own, Professor Monica Whitty, she pioneered online relationships research. And she and I almost finished our PhD at the same time. She went off to England and became very successful. She's now at Monash. And she really broke ground in a big way internationally. Humbly, I'd say my own work was probably more to do with online therapies because I was doing a lot with gaming and how gaming might be used for ADHD treatments, especially with biofeedback equipment. And a few others around the place, but we weren't coming out. It was almost like we were a repressed society. We weren't coming out saying we're cyber psychologists. We were still psychologists or behaviorists or clinicians who happened to use technology and evidence base it to do what we wanted to do in behavioral science. So 2017 was really the moment. And I'm again very humbled to say that Sydney Uni backed me to launch the first group in Australia. And since then, bringing up to 2024, there's about five different cyber psychology research groups across many different universities in Australia. And we're starting to build a community of practice down here. The irony being is that we're actually publishing quite a lot through all those decades. And the AIM mental health was really a hot topic in Australia because we have such a rural population that we can't reach with health services, that online services was what needed to be pioneered. And that was done by some great Australians like Professor Helen Christensen, who I think is now an emeritus professor at University of New South Wales, and did Mood Gym Online. We've got Patrick McGorry, who's done Headspace. And so we've got some very big names and big projects that were rolled out, but it wasn't grabbing the institutes down here as in this is a major discipline yet. But I think we're almost there.
Talking about that, you do quite a bit of work and research advising about technology amongst young people and how it affects their development. Do you have any primary concerns with young people and digital technology use?
Oh, absolutely. I think any psychologist would say that there is definitely concerns here. And so we've got some real solid evidence base after 20 years, thank God, which is showing that, you know, early use of tablet computers in toddler use is not great for neural development. There's the adage of screen time with sleep disorders that's very substantiated now. But screen time has been overused in a lot of ways of, you know, what is good content, what is bad content. In other words, you can't just say time in front of a screen. It's what are you doing on that screen? But the biggest one really is the use of social media and how it has impacted adolescent development and teenage development in general. And so we've certainly seen the nasties in the media, the very considerable concerns of cyberbullying, online harm, weight disorders, eating disorders, and of course, suicide. So those have been major concerns. But we've also, in my team's work, seen how we can use social media if it's built at a custom level. So we're not talking your big platforms like Facebook necessarily, to help young people with mental health disorders. And we fortunately were over nearly 12 years able to get a lot of industry money together to help Kids Helpline in Australia develop their own social media platform, which now is rolled out to hundreds and thousands of kids aged between 13 to 25. And I say kids lightly because it is adolescents as well and earlier young adults between Australia and New Zealand, in a platform called My Circles. So we've found that social media in the right way is used in very strict protocols with counselors can bring youth together with same mental health disorders to talk to each other in a safe environment and get the mental health they need 24/7, especially in a management context. So sort of bringing this back to basics, I think what we've been able to do is show that technology can be safe, but we can't just take it off the shelf. We've got to put systems and places into practice.
So in terms of My Circle, you mentioned our initial chat that it's about teenagers helping each other. Is there kind of clinicians who get involved in My Circle, and how do children engage with the platform, and how does it really benefit them on a day-to-day or longer-term basis?
The short answer is yes, we have counsellors involved. That's what the Kids Helpline service does best. They've been running in Australia since the 1990s, which was the old telephone call-up service. It was a free call anywhere in Australia to talk to a counsellor about anything from domestic violence, depression, anxiety, drug, alcohol, a whole range of issues, LGBTQI issues as well. And then during the late 90s, early 2000s, they could see the drop off in phone calls and the demand for online going up. But young people, they wanted more than just an email or a direct message or a discussion board even, because we've got some other services here that do great work with discussion boards. They wanted a community. And so we came in around 2010 with a concept. And we actually took the concept to Google and a few other places. So Google Circles was running at that time. We thought maybe Google would back us. Essentially what we found was the tech companies didn't want to support health at that time. It was a very dangerous area for obvious reasons. And Kids Helpline said, look, we have a need. We've got young people who want to have a social network. Can we just roll out Facebook or can we just do that? And immediately we proved that's not safe either. So we started from scratch and we realized we had to build it. We got computer technicians in and all sorts of things. We had Australian Federal Police also looking at how could we track kids in danger and how do we give some anonymity to kids, not complete anonymity, but anonymity in the groups with each other, but the counselor knows who they are. And so we set a clinician model, a social media engagement model, and a design model using young people from different ages. The one thing we found is that young people wanted to move with the technology. So if something was very popular as a function on Facebook, we had to have it in our social network as well. And the main thing we found was that the more we engaged them, the more we learnt. We actually learnt more by working with the clients than I think we did with any technical service, mental health service or anything. So the kids really drove and built My Circle. So that's a long-winded answer, but the main thing is after 5 randomized control trials and various other ways of comparing online and offline CBT, counseling, education, psychoeducation programs, we built a community that are around disorders. So kids come into a group that are a depression group or an anxiety group, a stressed student group around studying. And then the biggest one that happened organically was the COVID group. We had all the kids living at home and they had to study and socialize. And we saw the gap in mental health services really come up quite large at that time and kids coming online to talk to others through their isolating experiences. And so we were very fortunate. We got backing from Bupa, the health agency, health foundation, and we finished the project in 2022. And it's now live and open to anybody for free. So it's a great service and something myself and my team are very proud of.
That's extraordinary. And I suppose also with Australia, it's a very unique environment and that's a relatively small population versus other Western countries in such a big geographic area. So for a lot of young people, it may be really tricky to find the right kind of counsellor or psychologist or therapist who will help them with their specific issue. So, and also to get that kind of social support is critical if you're so isolated.
That's right. And we particularly found that with Indigenous youth. Those in regional or rural Australia, which have very little health services. So if you say, go see a psychologist, then they're like, well, that's 600 kilometres away, quite literally. I mean, I know in England, what would that be from, you know, Southampton up to the Land's End? I don't know.
Probably up to Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, there you go. So, I mean, you know, you can't say to somebody in regional or rural Australia, go get mental health at your local doctor or something like that, that they don't have it. But then also when we saw kids that were coming up with sexual identity questions and community in regions that they couldn't talk to anybody about it, and drug and alcohol issues, and unfortunately one of the larger ones is domestic violence as well. The one thing that was overwhelming was young people saying they wanted to create their own groups around their issues. So getting counsellors who are trained in those issues for those particular groups is a challenge. But Kids Helpline does an amazing job upskilling their staff, getting the right courses in place, and developing psychoeducation material as well and support services. So this is the other thing that's probably really great about it was they didn't get rid of their call service model of one-to-one. They actually said, if you want to be in these groups, but you still want to talk to a counselor one-on-one, you still can. You can break off, do direct messaging, or you can phone us or all these other modalities. So really, we just gave a new string to their bow. And we're really hoping to see that this kind of model of allowing privacy, anonymity, and still clinician overview can be developed for more customized social networks for many different purposes, but mental health would be great to see grow.
You spoke about screen time earlier on, and it is a concept that a lot of cyber psychologists talk about, or actually it's just such a generic term. And a lot of parents use that to talk about the time their child spends on a digital device, but actually it doesn't really mean anything. And can you kind of talk about what parents need to think about when they talk about screen time, and what is actually something they need to look for and be more concerned about than how much time they're spending on?
Absolutely. Look, I'm a big advocate that screen time is a bit of a redundant term to talk about good and bad online. When you just take the obvious, when you say to somebody, don't spend time on your phone, what are they going to do? Find a computer, or they're going to find a tablet, or they're going to find a TV. They're going to be in front of a screen somewhere getting information and content. So what we really need to look at is something we talked about with a company that I was doing consultancy with, an international company, HP, you know, the printers and so on. So HP had a responsible tech engagement program just before COVID hit. They wanted to develop, what are the things that are meaningful online that we do? What are the things that are not meaningful? And let's be aware of those meaningful and not meaningful experiences so that we can at least understand when we're wasting time or procrastinating, or we're actually doing something that could be actually good for our outside mental health or well-being in general. So we had a wonderful time. We developed a tool called Reflect. It was spelt funny. I have to admit, R-E-F-L-C-T. And it gave a visual chart or a visual representation of the time you spend online. We did not want to say 2 hours online of screen time is bad. And I'm not sure in the United Kingdom if you have government guidelines of what's the recommended time online. In Australia, we do of 2 hours. And when you dig down on that 2 hours, where did that come from? It goes back to a policy that came out in 1955 for TV use. So it's never been updated. There's no real science behind it. It's just 2 hours sounds about right. Who wants to sit in front of a TV for 2 hours? So what we took is an idea of how do we conceptualize balance of four pillars of things we tend to put our time into, and then decide, are we spending too much time on one thing, not enough on another, and do we feel balanced with the productivity and the reward we get from engaging in the online world? And the very simple model was based on Bronfheimer's idea of human beings need to be connected socially through family, friends, community, and work. Now, that isn't the four pillars. We divided the four pillars down into the most obvious tasks we do online. One is work and productivity. And if you're a student, that would fall into that as well. So we didn't put down education. We put work and productivity together. Creativity. In other words, what are we doing, which could also be playing games, which is leisure as well, but maybe you're thinking strategies, or maybe you're designing a website, or maybe you're into music or something like that. We wanted things that you are interacting with that felt as though I'm creating. And we saw that also with influencers and things like that. Health and welfare. How many people research something online that's going to help their lives? We found a lot of people obviously learn about exercise, diet, lifestyle changes, finance changes, all of these feed into health and welfare or health and well-being. So that was in that bucket. And then the last bucket was actually where we looked at our social connections, and we're talking about the meaningful social connections, not the I've got 1 million people on Instagram I update every day, but the small groups of direct messaging on WhatsApp that we've got for, you know, our tight groups of people we want to have private chats with, and the photos we share and how we share and so on. So we didn't define them, the Reflect tool, in great detail because we wanted people to still be individualized about thinking about what they define as creativity, productivity, health and wealth, well-being, and social connectedness. And then they put all this into a tool that's on a web-based, and I'm happy to provide the link, it still exists, that provides a visual representation of a circle. And the circle's either big or small, or it's sometimes asymmetrical, all depending on how much time and what you define the time it is that you're doing. It becomes four circles at the end that turns into a sphere, and it's also played to music. And the music sort of gives you a sense of intense work or not intense work, relaxation, not relaxation, and so on. The main thing we wanted to give was a sensory perception of your time online of, does it feel harmonious to you or is it not harmonious? And when we launched it with the general managers of HP in Australia, I think we had close to 2 million hits in the first few weeks. It dies off over time, of people going, finally, I don't feel guilty about being online, but I now understand that there's a good time to be online to do things in the bad time. And one example that we gave in a particular interview was, if you're on a flight, and I'll use Sydney to London in this instance, that's a long time in the air. Now, you could be extremely productive in that time. You're stuck in a chair. You can't walk around too much, but you could be very productive in your online world. But if you're sitting in a chair for 14 hours in your office, that's not good for you. So it's about where you are as well, where you're connecting. If people are spending a lot of time FaceTiming, it could be because they're far apart. So we wanted that in a perspective of screen time as well. We're trying to rejig, and to bring this sort of long ramble to a conclusion, we're trying to rejig people's mindsets that don't think in screen time. Think about where you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing it. And that will make you a much happier person.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things is everyone feels so much guilt around the concept of spending so much time online, and especially when we get those stats of how many hours we're on our phone. And actually, I think as cyber psychologists, we've got a big job to do to change that perspective away from feeling guilty about spending time on technology and into a space of actually using it as a tool. This is about improving your productivity or improving your connectivity with others around the world or whatever that is. And I think that's a massive job we've got to do. And that's such a nice tool to be able to showcase, actually, there is a good harmony there.
We really want people to, and I think you hit the nail on the head then by saying not feel guilty. We certainly know that if you're a child and spending a long time online playing games, okay, that's not good. But imagine it's a Saturday night, it's raining outside, you can't go anywhere, and your mum and dad sit down and play those games with you. That could be a long period of time, but that's a long period of good time. So that's that attitude, that nuance that we want to look at of where you are, why you're doing what you're doing, and how it makes you feel in the long term.
Exactly. And I think that's where we need to get to, and that's what we're aiming for, hopefully, changing perspectives. Just talking about the cyber psychology research group that you've started quite a number of years ago at Sydney University. There's a lot of things that you focus on in your research, but what are the main things? Are there those four pillars you spoke about earlier, or are there other areas that you look at that are kind of more your main focus?
So our main focus right now, you know, in 2024 is to probably, I would say, pressing media issues. We are now focusing a lot more on security issues, particularly AI and deepfakes. And we have industry partners we're working with, like ID Care in Australia, which is a big Australian and New Zealand organization that looks after people that have unfortunately become victims of scams. We're trying to understand the cyber psychology of deception and how can we challenge fake news or challenge being duped online. That's one part of the CRG or the Cyber Psychology Research Group at the moment. The other part is more applied mental health. How do we actually take consumer technology, evidence-based it for a mental health or wellness outcome? That could be as simple as a wearable, or it could be an app, or it could be a game, but it does at the moment heavily involve the constant iterative change of VR and AR and moving to mixed realities as well. So we're split into two camps, I suppose. One is the cybersecurity camp of cyber psychology, and one is the mental health camp of cyber psychology. But we've got a number of people in the team that come at cyber psychology even from a different discipline point of view, where behavior is still the focus, the psychology is still the focus. But sociologically, they might be thinking, well, what's the global impact of this? So we have a sociologist in our team that is really interesting. How are we using social media to make decisions? Because a lot of people don't have the health literacy to go and look up health problems, and they go to social media groups or follow influencers to get their health information. And so we've got a sociologist doing that. We have a behavioral scientist. She's not a psychologist, but excellent in working with children, and particularly works in Pacific Island regions of Australia, or then not of Australia, their own countries, Namibia. We've got New Caledonia and a whole host of places. And they're looking at how youth view how technology could be used to help them in regional, remote, and isolated areas for their health and well-being as well. And so in a way, that's almost a mixture of behavior and anthropology. So we don't have one main focus. And I'm sorry to say that, you know, we probably can't say that the Cyber Psychology Research Group at Sydney covers everything as well, but we try to move with what's most important and pressing with the topics in the world right now. That is hard to do because it moves so fast. But social media is one that's not going to go away. Gaming doesn't go away. AI, I don't think it's going to go away. So that's kind of where we hitch our wagons to. So we build that body of literature and work and hopefully application from it as well.
And it sounds that a lot of the work you do is with young people, so children and teens. Do you focus on adult use of technology as well, or is it just children and teens?
So that's a really good question. The majority of the history of the CRG at Sydney Uni has mostly been youth mental health. Having said that, in the last 2 years, we've started pivoting, and that pivoting is definitely for cybersecurity. We're dealing with all ages. And unfortunately, the age group there that's most at risk is retirees. So we're getting over 60s that are victimized the most, being that they're investing their superannuation or pensions into new schemes. But I've also been working with veterans who have returned from Afghanistan and other areas of the world and looking at PTSD treatments. So we have this age group of about late 20s to early 50s that have gone through different traumatic disorders, from PTSD, obviously, but traumatic brain disorders as well. We've been working collaboratively with speech pathologists on getting people to reconnect neural pathways using VR to be in social situations to relax their anxiety of being in a social situation. So we are moving, I would say, across the lifespan. And in fact, my wife, who's not a cyber psychologist, she is a psychologist, she's in aged care, and she is in dementia care specifically. So using VR and dementia is something as a calming tool that's being verified, and she did that some years ago. And the other one, again, coming back to COVID, we had emergency rooms absolutely backed up and distributing VR headsets to people in waiting rooms so that they can immerse themselves and disengage from stress and worry for long periods of time allowed nurses to not only have a calmer workplace, but actually allowed people to get through the system a lot faster by actually not panicking and causing a thing we have here called code blacks. I don't know if they have them in English hospitals, but essentially it's where a patient gets angry and maybe violent, not only with doctors and nurses, but even patients that they feel have got more attention than them. And we found that de-escalated their anger response. And so really, I think we are moving across the lifespan now, but I think we started with youth because they were the most focused on using technology. So we had to go where our consumer base was.
Do you think there's a difference in age groups and technology use, or has it come down to the uses and gratifications of the specific person at the specific life stage?
I think that's a great question. And I think the answer was, like in the early 2000s, there was marked difference, and it was really to do with digital skills. You know, we had a term in Australia that I thought was kind of, I don't know, naff. It was silver surfers, you know, that these were the new retirees, the early 2000s, and they were learning to surf the web and they were given computer workshops to how to do Google searches and whatever else, or Alta Vista searches back then. I think that's well gone. I don't think there's anybody now who doesn't have some digital literacy or digital skills to some degree with all the different interfaces we have. Having said that, the nuance of what do they prefer of platform use, operating system use, how they consume different avenues of technology, you know, whether it be YouTube or where they get their digital sources of information from, that's very age specific. We're starting to see, you know, preference there. So the biggest example would be we're seeing older Facebook users and younger Instagram, TikTok users. So, you know, while there's similarities in social media use from both groups, how they digest it and how they want to actually impact or input is different. And I think we're seeing across the board more savviness of smaller groups of connectivity are better than larger groups. So I think that's been a big ubiquitous change across the ages. I definitely think that there is a fascination as well now with Gen Xers and baby boomers knowing more about technology than perhaps when they were in their their careers right in the middle and going, I don't have time to upskill these things. And I also think the ability to stay connected with their kids as they get older is driving that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder also with the dispersion of people across the globe, a lot of people, especially kind of middle age to older age, are by need states are kind of getting more connected rather than just, oh, I need to do my banking. But actually, that's another thing is that you need to do your banking online. So you have to know how to do it.
Exactly. I mean, a tax return or, you know, buying tickets to go overseas, whatever. You're forced in that direction. We're all corralled in that direction. But I think people are now going, there is so much information we're putting in. Maybe I should take some responsibility for it. Where you go back 15 years and most people are like, oh, I'll just put the same password into everything, or I'll forget about bookmarking that or looking at cookies and cash. I think we're all starting to pick up skills that are just the natural world now that we live in, which is a hybrid digital world.
So let's talk about Sydney University and what you offer there. So your main academic role is based in Sydney. So what are the various undergrad and postgrad courses that you offer students?
So the Cyber Psychology Research Group is predominantly a research-focused degree program, meaning that we offer masters and PhDs to anybody in the world that wants to come here. So that's our main doorway to international students. In the undergraduate sense, we have a number of programs from, you know, Bachelor of Psychology right through to Bachelor of Health Science, or we call it Science and Health, Medicine, you name it. I work in the Faculty of Medicine and Health, which is an incredibly large faculty. And the amount of courses we offer there at undergraduate level are huge. But we don't offer a course at undergraduate level in cyber psychology. We are hoping to, but it's a very long process. And what we are looking to do at the moment is work with Asia Pacific University and a few other universities where we offer placement programs for people to come out and do a visit for one of our units of study. So I teach a unit called Cyber Psychology and Digital Health. Has a code BIDH3146 if anyone is interested in looking it up online. And in that course, you just literally are immersing yourself in all the areas of cyber psychology. We do a very brief introduction of why are we looking at the study of behavior online and why historically it's important to why it's future importance, how it has future importance. And then we look at applications. So we do a class on gaming, a class on the advent of VR and how it's going to change to Web 3.0 tools, AI, obviously. We're doing scam deception behaviors and understanding how scams work and the behavior behind that. And we also talk a lot about online ethics. You know, how do we actually report fake news or interact with the right sources? How do we know to find the right resources? So there's a wide spectrum of things there. Being it's only one unit, we can't obviously get everything in that we want to do. But we are hoping very soon to offer units in cyber psychology treatments. So we'll be looking at VR treatments for PTSD, anxiety, stress, those sorts of disorders. This is probably more of a graduate certificate level or master's level. But Asia Pacific University is looking at offering a master's in cyber psychology, and Sydney Uni in with me is going to be teaching into it as well. So that's something that's coming in the next few years, I hope. Having said that, if a student wanted to come down an evidence-based practice, you know, if they're a psychologist already and they say, I want to work in VR games, that's something we are expert in. We've been doing that for quite some time. So that's really our whole offering. We plug into other degree programs and you come out the other end, usually with a PhD in cyber psychology or a master in applied science in cyber psychology.
Let's focus on the VR and games area of your kind of expertise. It's often a focus of moral panic amongst the media in general, probably because it's quite a new area and there's a lot of hype around children who display violent behavior in the real world who they then pin on violent video games. Do you think VR and video gaming deserves the bad press that it gets and what is often highlighted in the media as?
I'm going to be a bit black and white here and the answer is no. I don't believe it does. Now that for those viewers that are watching this and thinking, oh, okay, Dr. Campbell's a crackpot. Hear me out. Gaming disorder alone is something that is not well researched to the levels that we can say it does or does not lead to all these very negative outcomes. What we can say is contributes to negative outcomes. An example of this, and I teach my students this, is that gaming is not something that's going to cause depression, but it may actually impact depression. So a child who's gaming to get away from problems may have already had depression start or depressive symptoms start, and the gaming is the escape world that they go into. And unfortunately, may not make them feel better, even though they feel better playing the game. So that's one thing we've got evidence about. We actually have studies that show this from 1998 onwards. But then there's the other side, the aggression and the antisocial behavior. Now, that may not have been there before the gaming, and the types of games, the topics of the games, and the amount of time on, and the sleep deprivation, various other things, they can be attributed to a gaming disorder of some type. But again, we've got to look at the environmental impact. And this is not pathology here. It might be they're not coping with other challenges they have in their lives. So they've decided to socially withdraw. And the social aspect is something we've got to look at as much as we look at the biological and pathological impact of mental health. So the negative part of the media is a case of gaming equals X. And that's the part we need to pull apart. I think it would be the same as saying eating food makes us fat. It's too simplistic. We really have to look at what kinds of food, how much food, and is it always every day, that sort of thing. You know, is there ebbing and flowing? So gaming and VR, if we start looking at that, we've got to look at balance. We've got to look at parental education. We've got to look at digital citizenship. We have to understand how we use it appropriately. But I don't think this is too much different from my traditional training in child psychology, where I'd say we'd be doing the same for teaching children about how to play sport in a nice and collaborative way, or how to interact socially, or how to look after yourself, but from basic hygiene to sleep to diet and exercise. We need to build in what is now known as digital citizenship into part of the education strategy of how kids are raised around technology.
And a lot of parents kind of think that children should learn a lot of this digital citizenship at school, or it should be teachers that are teaching them, or they should go online and look and learn this stuff and not necessarily take full responsibility. But there are parents who are really concerned about this and don't quite have the tools or the knowledge of how to help their child. So are there any specific things that parents need to look out for that may indicate that a child is kind of going down the slightly obsessive route or in gaming or VR?
The number one thing, if we look at the warning signs, it would be a case of social disengagement as the first thing. And what we've found over numerous studies between Asia Pacific areas, particularly China and Korea, which the most amount of research has come out about gaming disorder, is that if a person is not performing well, not just at school, we're not talking grades, but their social network is small, or they're not getting their needs met of intellectual needs and other creative needs, they will find it elsewhere. And what we see is that when young people go online, the two things they're searching for is like-mindedness and how much like-mindedness can I get? So the first part is, I want to meet people like me. Now that I have, how much time can I have with them? Because they finally feel they've found their tribe. So gaming is one of those, I wouldn't even say double-edged. It's one of those environments where you get this fulfillment of people understand each other because we're playing by the same rules. That's what the game does. It gives you a social construct. And secondly, you're talking about the game. You're on Discord playing with other people around the world in the game. You're sharing tactics and strategies. You may have in-jokes while playing the game. It is its own social world. We have 2.64 billion gamers, we believe, on the planet. 2.64. Now, this is a moving feast of statistics every year, because that number is not about people that play games dedicatedly 4 hours a day. That number includes people who might play solitaire on their phone. But when we break that 2.64 billion down to the gamers that may have problems, it's about 5%, 5% of that number. Now, why are they having problems? The number one reason they report is social disassociation. They do not feel connected to their community, their family, their potential friend group at school. They're exhausted. We've found that those in Asia countries or Asia Pacific region countries are hothoused in their education. They have very little leisure time. So the leisure time they have is accessibility, or have an accessibility issue. They can't necessarily go to a park. They go online. And that's where the behavior starts. So to come back and answer your question of what are the warning signs, social disconnectedness, sleep disruption, and aggression. Those three are the biggest And if you start seeing that, yes, we can certainly do the pediatric assessment of are they going through puberty. But we've also got to take into account how often are we seeing those moods and why are they unreasonable? Are they getting to a point where it's like, leave me alone, just let me do this and not wanting to communicate? Or are they like, I just need some downtime and I'm going to explain to you that I'm going to go game? So it's all about that connectedness. And I think it's the dynamic of the family. If you were a close family and you suddenly aren't close, okay, time to look into a little bit. If you weren't close and suddenly this behavior comes, and this is most parents I meet, unfortunately, they think, how do I stop it? But they seldom realize how it started, which was the disconnectedness to begin with. It's a very complex area.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think for parents, if they are concerned, do you think part of the solution, way to get to that point of connectedness, is to open up a conversation with their child, not from a negative viewpoint of stop screen time, but more around kind of just starting chatting to them initially and then also educate themselves as to the benefits of gaming and how they can.
You nailed it then on the last part. What we've found is, and we've done this in Sydney, I've done it in my own clinical work, having a parent confront a child saying, tell me why you game, the child will clam up, say, you won't understand. The best way to start the discourse of, can I get you to change your behavior, is not telling, but having them show you the game, why it's important to them, to literally take the time to be investing your time in that game with them. You may not like the game, you may not want to play the game, but it is so important to understand everything about it so that when you say to them, okay, now that I get where your head's at and why this is doing what it does for you, I need to say, this is what we need to balance it, rather than, and what we've seen with most parents saying, you've got 1 hour, get off or you're in trouble. And then, and this is a very simple anecdote from a client who said to me, they have no idea how an hour online could be wasted if I finish right there and I don't save the level. Or my friends rely on me because I'm part of a team, and if I drop out, I affect all their lives. It's those little things that matter a lot to social cohesion in the game and also effort to the game. So I put it to parents that I've worked with was, play the game, learn the rules, have conversations about it, and then start talking about balance of time.
So it is a process of building that relationship. And as you said, children go online for that connection. And once they get the connection with others, it builds that community. And if you are coming in as an outsider saying, you have to get out of that community right now, there is an element of disruption and discord emotionally for them. So it could be a real area of conflict. And you were talking earlier about children getting aggressive. And is that really both verbally aggressive and physically aggressive?
Unfortunately, yes. So in the most severe cases, we've seen domestic violence from particularly teenage boys, where they've literally thrown objects or hit their parent or even done it towards siblings. When it's got to that level, we are at a bit of a crisis level. And I use the word crisis very gently here in the sense of get help, get them to a psychologist, get them to your doctor and get a mental health plan in Australia. That's the way we would do it. Taking them straight to a psychiatrist, I'll be honest with you, is not going to help, because a psychiatrist is going to look at it as in, well, how do I medicate? And it's not about medication. It's really about behavioral regulation, you know, internal regulation of emotion, and getting them to understand their flare-up points. What we do in those situations where we've got a violent child based around gaming is we look at the trigger points and get the child to articulate, or the adolescent to articulate, what they recall of why they went from 0 to 100, and literally write it down or explain it. And once they get this dialogue going of, this is how I'm feeling, this is how I'm thinking, this is why I do what I do, instead of the parents making a judgment, we actually get the parent to say, do you realize it is harmful to us? And it's not just about you, it's about the family and the family unit. We play, if you will, to the angle of empathy and sympathy, and then we get them to look at alternative means so that when it comes up again, the parents can say, we've discussed this, now what do you want to do about it? So it takes a lot of therapy. It takes a lot of time to de-escalate, but in most cases it works. If we treat the same as we would somebody with oppositional defiant disorder, we look at developing the empathy and the understanding of the situation to de-escalate and use language rather than violence.
Currently, cyber psychologists are mostly found in academia, cyber security, and clinical psychology. Where do you think the future lies with cyber psychology?
From my perspective, industry. And with that, I mean almost every industry you can possibly think about. Every corporation, engineering facility, production facility, hospital, school, the list goes on, requires behavioral understanding of complex systems and human factors. And so we're not removing and we don't stop thinking about the person in cyber psychology. In fact, the person is at the center of technology. It's not that technology is at the center of humanity. At the end of the day, we built it. We don't want it to control us. We need to understand how to control it, particularly as AI and misinformation keeps going on. But we also need to know how we can integrate it better to make industry more efficient and also work-life balance. One of the things we know overwhelmingly is when email came about as a major tool in industry, burnout started going up because of burnout experiences. We found overwork happening, being connected all the time. In Australia, we have only just this month passed disconnection laws that your boss is not allowed to email you unless it's an emergency or expect you to respond on a weekend unless it's an emergency. And that means using that red exclamation mark on your email. So disconnection is something that we know actually makes people healthier and thus more productive. So workplace turnover, industry and corporate knowledge retention, productivity increasing through new technologies and new ways of actually working in collaborative fashions with new technology. These are things cyber psychologists study. There was an area of psychology many, many years ago. It was made up multidisciplinary areas of time and motion. We used to study time and motion studies, very organizational psychology. Cyber psychology now can actually do that and bring in, have you thought about using this technology in this way rather than what's coming off the shelf saying this is the best way to use it? We look at it as human-centered technology, where technologists and software designers see it as in engineered technology. So I think cyber psychology is going to be within 10 years easily, actually probably 5 in Australia because we're starting to see it take up heavily in industry, be advisors and directors of how can we interface systems, particularly complex systems, and update those systems readily to not disrupt human interaction and human factors in being productive and healthy.
There's almost, in my head, it sounds as though that's almost giving empathy and a human element to technology.
I like to think of it that way as well. We just don't want to see, the most common workplace would say in any given year, 6 or 7 systems would be rolled out, whether it be an accounting system or a meeting system or a calendar system or so on. That adds a lot of stress to us when we have to learn something new, integrate it into our lives, and redo things the way we had got used to doing in a habitual way. But if we can actually understand how a business works and what they need to achieve, we can then look at incremental changes rather than mass change that can upset productivity and all those things. And that is looking at human-centered feelings, emotions, and individuality. We can't work as a collective. You know, we're not machines. So how do we get the best out of a collective of people with individual differences?
So Andrew, we're coming on to the standard questions I ask my guests at the end of the podcast. And the first is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
Oh, what is the threat of technology? I think the reason why I raise that is because AI is always talked about, you know, it is the greatest threat to humanity. And I don't take it lightly. I think that there is definite threats there and we're already seeing manipulations of that technology. I actually think still the greatest threat to of technology to us is the fact that if we don't use it in the best ways possible. And I don't mean that AI is going to destroy us. It's a case of if we're not making decisions about how to use AI before we build it or before we implement it. I go back, the evidence I put behind this is if we looked at when the World Wide Web really went live in 1995, I mean, it was around long before that, but it wasn't the WWW. It was just the internet and you needed codes and you needed to understand programming to interact with it. But when the World Wide Web and search engines really came on, I don't think anybody imagined how it would change the fabric of the individual society in each country and also the global community and the way we communicate and do business and education and so on. I don't think anybody really understood how revolutionary it was. I think we're at that crossroad again right now with machines helping us to do our jobs by actually doing cognitive rationalization. And if we don't understand that there is a fine line between accurate information and inaccurate information, and we allow that gap to get wider and wider of we can't tell the difference, that's the biggest threat I think we're dealing with here, is misinformation. So we really need to teach critical thinking skills, and we need to adapt those critical thinking skills to how do we curtail AI to do certain things and not all things. But that's my perspective.
That's a brilliant perspective. I completely agree with you. I think it is. There's a lot of education we need to do for ourselves, but also within the university sector as well as the schooling sectors, how do we teach people how to be more critically aware? And not about being critical, but being critically aware of what is going on, and how we separate out the reality from misinformation.
Absolutely. I think if your viewers haven't seen the movie Idiocracy, which was a 2007 film, watch that. It sums it all up.
The second question is, and there's often a frustration among cyber psychologists that journalists can take snippets of academic findings and sensationalize them to get clickbait and drive a bit of moral panic and kind of build a social narrative around digital technology that helps them get additional funds in their coffers. Mm. Do you think that media is getting better or worse at this properly representing academic findings?
Oh, that's a tough question, because I'd have to pull it apart a little bit by saying it depends on the media, the media source or the media institute, if you will. In Australia, unfortunately, like I think in most Western media countries, we do have left and right media, political valued media. And I do think there's sensationalization on both sides. I don't want to say there is only one sided. It definitely is not. However, I think the one thing we've got to be able to say in the media about technology is that every piece of technology is still under some development stage. We can't just go, this is now fully ready to go and away we go. GPS, for example, is something that still can have errors in it. So we might rely on it to fly an aircraft using GPS, which is what we do every day, but it can still have errors. So that level of caution in the media, I think, is not always there. I think it's always new breakthrough, this is going to happen, or doom and gloom, this is going to happen. I'd really like to see a little bit more of the balanced argument. And I think we really need that in the age of AI, particularly.
I wonder how much clickbait that generates of a balanced viewpoint. And I think that's where we may struggle with trying to.
I agree. I think the rabbit holes that we go down when we're trying to learn is where that critical thinking skills we need to have, the traditional critical thinking skills of who is writing this? Why are they writing this? And am I really just getting diverse knowledge, or am I just getting one line of knowledge nonstop? And that's the thing that I think is difficult for the average user to understand, particularly as algorithms become more intelligent and evolve, and also political paths. Because if we take, we did a study at CRG at Sydney on how Facebook's being used in Myanmar to actually control the population's beliefs of the political system, and also persecute a religious group. And no one understood that there was other options to Facebook because it was not there. Same as what we see in China with Google and so on. So having external knowledge of the internet is just as important of how to get information off the internet. And that balance isn't there. We've seen that erode quite a lot. I do wonder how we're going to balance it. I don't have any answers on it. But I do think we need to teach it young. Question what you read.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree. So final question, Andrew, is what is your favorite cyber psychology book that you recommend others to read?
When we were first meeting and chatting and you said you probably asked that question, I thought to myself, oh, there's a number. But there's one that's about the ethics of digital psychology and cyber psychology. And it's written by Thomas Parsons. And the reason why I chose that after I went through a number of ones in my library was the ethical world online is not studied as much as I think it should be. How do we manipulate people? Why we manipulate people? And how you can report it, how you can actually get justifications. When we look at the legal aspects of damage done in the online world, there is actually very few cases that are repeated in case law, and I'm not a lawyer, that show this is how you can stop this from happening to larger groups. Now, I'm talking specifically here about radicalization or how we can use health information accurately. And understanding this, I think Thomas has gone into neurocog with it as well, making decisions of higher order thinking, such as finance and so on. But I do think the ethics of cyber psychology and the ethics of digital psychology, as he also puts in the title, which is media in that sense, is something we really need to look at. With the ability that anyone could have a platform online, how ethical are those platforms?
Andrew, thank you so much for joining me in Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been such a delight to chat to you, and I do hope we get to chat again in the future.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.